Before then, our poor little planet will have become much too hot to live on. In 2 billion years, the sun will be 15% brighter than it is now, which means that the Earth will be like Venus is today. Nobody could live on Venus. The temperature there is over 400 degrees Celsius. But 2 billion years is a pretty long time, and humans will almost certainly be extinct long before then, so that there'll be nobody left to fry. Or maybe our technology will have advanced to the point where we could actually move the Earth out to a more comfortable orbit. Later, when the helium-2 runs out, the sun will mostly disappear in a cloud of dust and debris, leaving a tiny core called a white dwarf, which will cool and fade.
Supernovas and stardust. The story ends differently for stars that are much bigger and hotter than our sun, like the giant stars we were just talking about. These monsters burn through their hydrogen much faster, and their hydrogen bomb nuclear furnaces go further than just banging hydrogen nuclei together to make helium nuclei. The hotter furnaces of larger stars go on to bang helium nuclei together to make even heavier elements, and so on until they have produced a wide range of heavier atoms. These heavier elements include carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and iron, but so far nothing heavier than iron, elements that are abundant on Earth and in all of us. After a relatively short time, a very large star like this eventually destroys itself in a gigantic explosion called a supernova, and it is in these explosions that elements heavier than iron are formed. What if Eta Carinae were to explode as a supernova tomorrow? That would be the mother of all explosions. But don't worry, we wouldn't know about it for another 8,000 years, which is how long it takes light to travel the vast distance between Eta Carinae and us. And nothing travels faster than light. What, then, if Eta Carinae exploded 8,000 years ago? Well, in that case, the light and other radiation from the explosion really could reach us any day now. The moment we see it, we'll know that Eta Carinae blew up 8,000 years ago. Only about 20 supernovas have been seen in recorded history. The great German scientist Johannes Kepler saw one on the 9th of October 1604. The debris has expanded since he first saw it. The explosion itself actually occurred some 20,000 years earlier, roughly the time the Neanderthal people went extinct. Supernovas, unlike ordinary stars, can create elements even heavier than iron, lead, for example, and uranium. The titanic explosion of a supernova scatters all the elements that the star and then the supernova have made, including the elements necessary for life, far and wide through space. Eventually, the clouds of dust, rich in heavy elements, will start the cycle again, condensing to make new stars and planets. That is where the matter in our planet came from, and that is why our planet contains the elements that are needed to make us, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so on. They come from the dust that remained after a long-gone supernova lit up the cosmos. That is the origin of the poetic phrase, "We are stardust." It is literally true. Without occasional, but very rare, supernova explosions, the elements necessary for life would not exist.
Going round and around. It is a fact we cannot ignore that the Earth and all the sun's other planets orbit their star in the same plane. What does that mean? Theoretically, you might think that the orbit of one planet could be tilted at any angle to any other. But that is not the way things are. It is as though there's an invisible flat disk in the sky, with the sun at the center, and all the planets are moving on that disk, just at different distances from the center. What's more, the planets all go round the sun in the same direction. Why? It is probably because of how they began. Let's take the direction of spin first. The whole solar system, which means the sun and the planets, began as a slowly spinning cloud of gas and dust, probably the leftovers of a supernova explosion. Like almost every other free-floating object in the universe, the cloud was spinning on its own axis. And yes, you've guessed it, the direction of its spin was the same as the direction of the planets now orbiting the Sun. Now, why are all the planets on the level of that flat disk? For complicated gravitational reasons that I won't go into, but which scientists understand well, a big spinning cloud of gas and dust out in space tends to form itself into a revolving disk, with a massive lump in the middle. And that is what seems to have happened with our solar system. Dust and gas and small chunks of matter don't stay as gas and dust. Gravitational attraction pulls them towards their neighbours in the way I described earlier in the chapter. They join forces with those neighbours and form larger lumps of matter. The larger a lump, the greater its gravitational pulling power. So what happened in our spinning disk was that the larger lumps became even larger as they sucked in their smaller neighbours. By far the largest lump became the Sun in the centre. Other lumps, large enough to attract smaller lumps to them, and far enough from the Sun not to be sucked into it, became the planets. Reading from nearest the Sun outwards, we now call them Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Old lists would put Pluto after Neptune, but nowadays it is regarded as too small to count as a planet.
Asteroids and shooting stars. Under different circumstances, another planet could have formed too, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. But the small bits that could otherwise have joined together to make this extra planet were prevented from doing so, probably by the brooding gravitational presence of Jupiter, and they have remained as an orbiting ring of debris called the asteroid belt. These asteroids swarm in a ring between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, which is where the extra planet would have been if they'd managed to get together. The famous rings around the planet Saturn are there for a similar reason. They could have condensed together to make another moon. Saturn already has 62 moons, so this would have been the 63rd, but they actually stayed separate as a ring of rocks and dust. In the asteroid belt, the Sun's equivalent of Saturn's rings, some of the bits of debris are large enough to be called planetesimals, sort of not-quite planets. The largest of them, called Ceres, is nearly 1,000 kilometres across, large enough to be roughly spherical like a planet, but most of them are just misshapen rocks and bits of dust. They collide with each other from time to time like billiard balls, and sometimes one of them gets kicked out of the asteroid belt and may even come close to another planet, such as Earth. We see them, quite commonly, burning in the upper atmosphere as shooting stars, or meteors. Less commonly, a meteor may be large enough to survive the ordeal of passing through the atmosphere and actually make a crash landing. On the 9th of October 1992, a meteor broke up in the atmosphere and a fragment about the size of a large brick hit a car in Peekskill, New York State. A much larger meteor, the size of a house, exploded above Siberia on the 30th of June 1908, setting fire to large areas of forest. Scientists now have evidence that an even larger meteor hit Yucatan in what is now Central America 65 million years ago, causing a global disaster, which is probably what killed off the dinosaurs. It has been calculated that the energy released by this catastrophic collision was hundreds of times greater than would be released if all the nuclear weapons in the world were simultaneously exploded in Yucatan. There would have been shattering earthquakes, epic tsunamis, and worldwide forest fires, and a dense cloud of dust and smoke would have darkened the Earth's surface for years. This would have starved the plants which need sunlight and starved the animals which need plants. The wonder is not that the dinosaurs died, but that our mammal ancestors survived. Perhaps a tiny population survived by hibernating underground.
Light of our lives. I want to end this chapter by talking about the importance of the Sun for life. We don't know whether there is life elsewhere in the universe, I'll discuss that question in a later chapter, but we do know that if there is life out there, it is almost certainly near a star. We can also say that, if it is anything like our kind of life at least, it will probably be on a planet about the same apparent distance from its star as we are from our sun. By apparent distance, I mean distance as perceived by the life form itself. The absolute distance could be very much greater, as we saw in the example of the supergiant star R136A1. But if the apparent distance were the same, their sun would look about the same size to them as ours does to us, which would mean that the amount of heat and light received from it would be about the same. Why does life have to be close to a star? Because all life needs energy, and the obvious source of energy is starlight. On Earth, plants gather sunlight and make its energy available to all other living creatures. Plants could be said to feed off sunlight. They need other things too, such as carbon dioxide from the air and water and minerals from the ground. But they get their energy from sunlight, and they use it to make sugars, which are a kind of fuel that drives everything else that they need to do. You can't make sugar without energy, and once you have sugar, you can then burn it to get the energy back out again, though you never get all of the energy back. There's always some lost in the process. And when we say burn, that doesn't mean it goes up in smoke. Literally burning it is only one way to release the energy in a fuel. There are more controlled ways to let the energy trickle out, slowly and usefully. You can think of a green leaf as a low, spread-out factory whose entire flat roof is one great solar panel, trapping sunlight and using it to drive the wheels of the assembly lines under the roof. That is why leaves are thin and flat, to give them a large surface area for sunlight to fall on. The end product of the factory is sugars of various kinds. These are then piped through the veins in the leaf to the rest of the plant, where they are used to make other things like starch, which is a more convenient way to store energy than sugar. Eventually, the energy is released from the starch or sugar to make all the other parts of the plant. When plants are eaten by herbivores, which means just that, plant eaters, such as antelopes or rabbits, the energy is passed to the herbivores, and again, some of it is lost in the process. The herbivores use it to build up their bodies and fuel their muscles as they go about their business. Their business includes, of course, grazing or browsing on lots more plants. The energy that powers the muscles of the herbivores as they walk and munch and fight and mate comes ultimately from the sun, via plants. Then other animals, meat-eaters or carnivores, come along and eat the herbivores. The energy is passed on yet again some of it is lost in the transition, and it powers the muscles of the carnivores as they go about their business. In this case, their business includes hunting down yet more herbivores to eat, as well as all the other things they do, like mating and fighting and climbing trees and, in the case of mammals, making milk for their babies. Still, it is the sun that ultimately provides the energy, even though by now that energy has reached them by a very indirect route. And at every stage of that indirect route, a good fraction of the energy is lost as heat, which contributes to the useless task of heating up the rest of the universe. Other animals, parasites, feed on the living bodies of both herbivores and carnivores. Once again, the energy that powers the parasites comes ultimately from the sun, and once again, not all of it is used, because some of it is wasted as heat. Finally, when anything dies, whether plant or herbivore or carnivore or parasite, it may be eaten by scavengers, like burying beetles, or it may decay, eaten by bacteria and fungi, which are just a different kind of scavenger. Yet again, the energy from the sun is handed on, and yet again, some of it leaks away as heat. That's why compost heaps are hot. All the heat in a compost heap comes ultimately from the sun, trapped by leafy solar panels the year before. There are fascinating Australasian birds called megapodes that use the heat of a compost heap to incubate their eggs. Unlike other birds which sit on their eggs and warm them with their body heat, megapodes build a big compost heap in which they lay their eggs. They regulate the temperature of the heap by piling more compost on the top to make it hotter or removing compost to make it cooler. But all birds ultimately use solar energy to incubate their eggs, whether through their body heat or through a compost heap. Sometimes plants are not eaten but sink into peat bogs. Over centuries they become compressed into layers of peat by new layers added above them. People in Western Ireland or the Scottish Isles dig up the peat and cut it into brick-sized chunks, which they burn as fuel to keep their houses warm in winter. Once again, it is trapped sunlight, in this case trapped centuries earlier, whose energy is being released in the fires and cooking ranges of Galway and the Hebrides.
Under the right conditions, and over millions of years, peat can become compacted and transformed so that it eventually becomes coal. Weight for weight, coal is a more efficient fuel than peat and burns at a much higher temperature, and it was coal fires and furnaces that powered the Industrial Revolution of the 18th and 19th centuries. Mill or a blast furnace, the glowing fireboxes that sent the Victorian steam engines thundering along iron rails, or their ships pounding through the sea. All that heat came originally from the sun, via the green leaves of plants that lived 300 million years ago. Some of the dark satanic mills of the Industrial Revolution were driven by steam power, but many of the earlier cotton mills were powered by water wheels. The mill was built near a fast-running river, which was ducted to flow over a wheel. This water wheel turned a great axle or drive shaft, which ran the length of the factory. All along the drive shaft, belts and cogwheels drove the various spinning machines and carding machines and looms. Even those machines were ultimately driven by the sun. Here's how. The water wheels were driven by water being pulled downhill by gravity. But that works only because there is a continuous supply of water up on the high ground from where it can run downhill. That water is supplied in the form of rain from clouds falling on the hills and mountains. And the clouds get their water through the evaporation of seas, lakes, rivers and puddles on Earth. Evaporation requires energy, and that energy comes from the sun. So ultimately, the energy that drove the water wheels, that turned the belts and cogwheels of the spinning machines and looms, all came from the sun. Later cotton mills were driven by coal-fired steam engines, again using energy ultimately from the sun. But before they switched to steam entirely, the factories went through an intermediate stage. They kept the great water wheel to drive the looms and shuttles, but used a steam engine to pump water up into a tank, from which it flowed down over the water wheel, only to be pumped back up again. So, whether the water is raised by the sun into the clouds, or whether it is raised by a coal-fired steam engine into a tank, the energy still comes from the sun in the first place. The difference is that the steam engine is driven by sunlight collected by plants millions of years ago, and stored underground in coal, whereas the water wheel on a river is driven by sunlight from only a few weeks ago and stored in the form of the water up at the top of the hills. This kind of stored sunlight is called potential energy because the water has the potential, the power within it, to do work as it flows downhill. This gives us a nice way to understand how life is powered by the sun. When plants use sunlight to make sugar, it's like pumping water uphill or into a tank on a factory roof. When plants, or the herbivores that eat the plants, or the carnivores that eat the herbivores, use the sugar, or the starch that's made from the sugar, or the meat that's made from the starch, we can think of the sugar as being burned, slow burned, to drive muscles, for instance, just as coal is fast burned, to make steam to propel a drive shaft in a factory.
It wouldn't do us any good if we literally burned our sugar and other food fuels by setting fire to them. Burning is a wasteful and destructive way to recover the sun's stored energy. What happens in our cells is so slow and carefully regulated that it is like water trickling down a hill and driving a series of water wheels. The sun-powered chemical reaction that goes on in green leaves to make sugar is doing the equivalent of pumping water uphill. The chemical reactions in animal and plant cells that use energy to drive muscles, for example, get the energy in carefully controlled stages, step by step. The high-energy fuels, sugars or whatever they are coaxed into releasing their energy in stages down through a cascade of chemical reactions, each one feeding into the next, like a stream tumbling down a series of small waterfalls, turning one small water wheel after another. Whatever the details, all the water wheels and cogs and drive shafts of life are ultimately powered by the sun. Perhaps those ancient peoples would have worshipped the sun even more devotedly if they had realized just how much all life depended on it. What I now wonder is how many other stars drive engines of life on their own orbiting planets. But that must wait for a later chapter.
Chapter 7. What is a rainbow? The Epic of Gilgamesh is one of the oldest stories ever written. Older than the legends of the Greeks or the Jews, it is the ancient heroic myth of the Sumerian civilization, which flourished in Mesopotamia, now Iraq, between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago. Gilgamesh was the great hero king of Sumerian myth, a bit like King Arthur in British legends, in that nobody knows whether he actually existed, but lots of stories were told about him. Like the Greek hero Odysseus, Ulysses, and the Arabian hero Sinbad the Sailor, Gilgamesh went on epic travels and he met many strange things and people on his journeys. One of them was an old man, a very, very old man, centuries old, called Utnapishtim, who told Gilgamesh a strange story about himself. Well, it seems strange to Gilgamesh, but it may not seem so strange to you because you have probably heard a similar story about another old man with a different name. Utnapishtim told Gilgamesh of an occasion many centuries earlier when the gods were angry with humankind because we made so much noise they couldn't sleep. The chief god, Enlil, suggested that they should send a great flood to destroy everybody so the gods could get a good night's rest. But the water god, Ea, decided to warn Utnapishtim. Ea told Utnapishtim to tear down his house and build a boat. It would have to be a very big boat because Utnapishtim was to take into it the seed of all living creatures. Utnapishtim built the boat just in time before it rained for 6 days and 6 nights without stopping. The flood that followed drowned everybody and everything that was not safely inside the boat. On the 7th day, the wind dropped and the waters grew calm and flat. Utnapishtim opened a hatch in the tightly sealed boat and released a dove. The dove flew away, looking for land, but failed to find any and returned. Then Utnapishtim released a swallow, but the same thing happened. Finally, Utnapishtim released a raven. The raven didn't come back, which suggested to Utnapishtim that there was dry land somewhere and the raven had found it. Eventually the boat came to rest on a mountain top, poking out of the water. Another god, Ishtar, created the first rainbow as a token of the god's promise to send no more terrible floods. So that is how the rainbow came into being, according to the ancient legend of the Sumerians. Well, we said the story would be familiar. All children reared in Christian, Jewish, or Islamic countries will immediately recognize that it is the same as the more recent story of Noah's Ark, with one or two minor differences. The name of the boat builder changes from Utnapishtim to Noah. The many gods of the older legend turn into the one god of the Jewish story. The seed of all living creatures becomes spelled out as every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort. Or, as the song has it, the animals went in two by two, and the Epic of Gilgamesh surely meant something similar. In fact, it is obvious that the Jewish story of Noah is nothing more than a retelling of the older legend of Utnapishtim. It was a folk tale that got passed around, and it travelled down the centuries. We often find that seemingly ancient legends have come from even older legends, usually with some names or other details changed. And this one, in both versions, ends with the rainbow. In both the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Book of Genesis, the rainbow is an important part of the myth. Genesis specifies that it was actually God's bow, which he put up in the sky as a token of his promise to Noah and his descendants. There's one more difference between the Noah story and the earlier Sumerian tale of Utnapishtim. In the Noah version, the reason for God's discontent with humans was that we were all incurably wicked. In the Sumerian story, humanity's crime was, you might think, less serious. We simply made so much noise the gods couldn't get to sleep. And the theme of noisy humans keeping the gods awake crops up quite independently in the legend of the Chumash people of Santa Cruz Island off the coast of California. The Chumash people believed that they were created on their island, it obviously wasn't called Santa Cruz then, because that is a Spanish name, from the seeds of a magic plant by the earth goddess Hutash, who was married to the sky snake, what we know as the Milky Way, which you can see on a really dark night in the country, but not if you live in a town where there's too much light pollution. The people of the island became very numerous, and just as in the Epic of Gilgamesh, too noisy for the goddess Hutash's comfort. The racket kept her awake at night. But instead of killing them all, like the Sumerian and Jewish gods, Hutash was kinder. She decided that some of them must move off Santa Cruz onto the mainland where she wouldn't be able to hear them. So she made a bridge for them to cross by, and the bridge was, yes, the rainbow. This myth has a strange ending. As the people were crossing over the rainbow bridge, some of the noisy ones looked down, and they were so frightened by the drop that they got dizzy. They fell off the rainbow into the sea, where they turned into dolphins.
The idea of the rainbow as a bridge crops up in other mythologies too. In Old Norse Viking myths, rainbows were seen as fragile bridges used by the gods to travel from the sky world to earth. Many peoples, for example in Persia, West Africa, Malaysia, Australia and the Americas, have seen the rainbow as a large snake which soars out of the ground to drink the rain. How do all these legends start, I wonder? Who makes them up, and why do some people eventually come to believe these things really happened? These questions are fascinating and not easy to answer. But there's one question we can answer. What is a rainbow really? The real magic of the rainbow. When I was about 10, I was taken to London to see a children's play called Where the Rainbow Ends. You almost certainly won't have seen it because it is too unfashionably patriotic for modern theatres to perform. It's all about how exceptionally special it is to be English, and as the climax of the adventure, the children are rescued by St. George, the patron saint of England. Not Britain, for Scotland, Wales and Ireland have their own patron saints. But what I most vividly remember is not St. George, but the rainbow itself. The children actually went to the place where the rainbow planted its foot, and we saw them walking about in the middle of the rainbow where it hit the ground. It was cleverly staged with coloured spotlights beaming down through swirling mist, and the children stumbled about in a spellbound daze. I think it was at about this moment that the shining armoured, silver-helmeted St. George appeared, and we children gasped at the scene as the children on the stage shouted, "St. George! St. George! St. George!" But it was the rainbow itself that seized my imagination. Never mind St. George, how wonderful it must be to stand right in the foot of a giant rainbow. You can see where the author of the play got the idea. A rainbow really does look like a proper object, hanging out there perhaps a few miles away. It seems to have its left foot planted, say, in a wheat field, and its right foot, if you're lucky enough to see a complete rainbow, on a hilltop. You feel you ought to be able to go straight to it and stand right where the rainbow steps on the ground, like the children in the play. All the myths I've described to you have the same idea. The rainbow is seen as a definite thing, in a definite place, a definite distance away. Well, you'll probably have worked out that it isn't really like that. First, if you try to approach the rainbow, no matter how fast you run, you'll never get there. The rainbow will run away from you until it fades away altogether. You can't catch it. But it isn't really running away, because it isn't really in a particular place at all, ever. It's an illusion, but a fascinating illusion, and understanding it leads on to all sorts of interesting things, some of which we'll come to in the next chapter.
What light is made of? First, we need to understand about something called the spectrum. It was discovered in the time of King Charles II, that's about 350 years ago, by Isaac Newton, who may well have been the greatest scientist ever. He discovered lots of other things besides the spectrum, as we saw in the chapter on night and day. Newton discovered that white light is really a mixture of all the different colours. To a scientist, that's what white means. How did Newton find this out? He set up an experiment. First, he blacked out his room so that no light could get in, and then he opened a narrow chink in the curtain so that a pencil-thin beam of white sunlight came in. He then let the beam of light pass through a prism, which is a sort of triangular chunk of glass. What a prism does is splay the narrow white beam out, but the splayed-out beam that emerges from the prism is no longer white. It is multicoloured, like a rainbow, and Newton gave a name to the rainbow he made, the spectrum. Here's how it works. When a beam of light travels through air and hits glass, it gets bent. The bending is called refraction. Refraction doesn't have to be caused by glass. Water does the trick too, and that will be important when we come back to the rainbow. It is refraction that makes an oar look bent when you stick it in the river. So, light is bent when it hits glass or water. But now here's the point. The angle of the bend is slightly different depending on what colour the light is. Red light bends at a shallower angle than blue light. So, if white light really is a mixture of coloured lights, as Newton guessed, what's going to happen when you bend white light through a prism? The blue light is going to bend further than the red light, so they will be separated from each other when they emerge from the other side of the prism. And the yellow and green lights will come out in between. The result is Newton's spectrum. All the colours of the rainbow arranged in the correct rainbow order: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet.
Newton wasn't the first person to make a rainbow with a prism. Other people had already got the same result. But many of them thought the prism somehow coloured the white light, like adding a dye. Newton's idea was quite different. He thought that white light was a mixture of all the colours, and the prism was just separating them from each other. He was right, and he proved it with a pair of neat experiments. First, he took his prism as before, and stuck a narrow slit in the way of the coloured beams coming out of it, so that only one of them, say the red beam, passed through the slit. Then he put another prism in the path of this narrow beam of red light. The second prism bent the light as usual, but what came out of it was only red light. No extra colours were added, as they would have been if what prisms did was add colour like a dye. The result Newton got was exactly what he expected, supporting his theory that white light is a mixture of light of all colours. The second experiment was more ingenious still, using three prisms. It was called Newton's Experimentum Crucis, which is Latin for critical experiment, or as we might say, experiment that really clinches the argument. White light passed through a slit in Newton's curtain and through the first prism, which spread it out into all the colours of the rainbow. The spread-out rainbow colours then passed through a lens, which brought them all together before they passed through the second of Newton's prisms. This second prism had the effect of merging the rainbow colours back into white light again. That already neatly proved Newton's point. But just to make quite sure, he then passed the beam of white light through a third prism, which splayed the colours out into a rainbow again. As neat a demonstration as you could wish for, proving that white light is indeed a mixture of all the colours.
How raindrops make rainbows. Prisms are all very well, but when you see a rainbow in the sky, there isn't a great big prism hanging up there. No, but there are millions of raindrops. So does each raindrop act as a tiny prism? It's a bit like that, but not quite. If you want to see a rainbow, you have to have the sun behind you when you look at a rainstorm. Each raindrop is more like a little ball than a prism, and light behaves differently when it hits a ball from how it behaves when it hits a prism. The difference is that the far side of a raindrop acts as a tiny mirror, and that is why you need the sun behind you if you want to see a rainbow. The light from the sun turns a somersault inside every raindrop and is reflected backwards and downwards where it hits your eyes. Here's how it works. You are standing with the sun behind and above you, looking at a distant shower of rain. The sunlight hits a single raindrop. Of course, it hits lots of other raindrops too, but wait, we're coming to that. Let's call our one particular raindrop A. The beam of white light hits A on its upper near surface, where it is bent, just as it was on the near surface of Newton's prism. And of course, the red light bends less than the blue, so the spectrum is already sorting itself out. Now all the coloured beams travel through the raindrop until they hit the far side. Instead of passing through into the air, they are reflected back towards the near side of the raindrop, this time the lower part of the near side. And as they pass through the near side of the raindrop, they are again bent. Again, the red light bends less than the blue. So, as the sunbeam leaves the raindrop, it has been splayed out into a proper little spectrum. The separated coloured beams, having doubled back around the inside of the raindrop, are now hurtling back in the general direction of where you are standing. If your eye happens to be in the path of one of those beams, say the green one, you'll see pure green light. Somebody shorter than you might see the red beam coming from A, and somebody taller than you might see the blue beam from A. Nobody sees the full spectrum from any one raindrop. Each of you sees only one pure colour. Yet all of you say you see a rainbow, with all the colours. How come? Well, so far we've only been talking about one raindrop, called A. There are millions of other raindrops, and they are all behaving in the same kind of way. While you are looking at A's red beam, there's another raindrop called B, which is lower than A. You don't see B's red beam because it hits you in the stomach, but B's blue beam is in exactly the right place to hit you in the eye. And there are other raindrops, lower than A but higher than B, whose red and blue beams miss your eye, but whose yellow or green beams hit your eye. So lots of raindrops together add up to a complete spectrum in a line up and down. But a line up and down is not a rainbow. Where does the rest of the rainbow come from? Well, don't forget that there are other raindrops, stretching from one side of the rain shower to the other and at all heights. And of course, they fill in the rest of the rainbow for you. Every rainbow you see, by the way, is trying to be a complete circle, with your eye at the centre of it, like the complete circular rainbow you sometimes see when you water the garden with a hose and the sun shines through the spray. The only reason we don't usually see the whole circle is that the ground gets in the way. So that's why you see a rainbow at any one split second. But in the next split second, all the raindrops have fallen to a lower position. A has now fallen to where B was, so you now see A's blue beam instead of its green one. And you can't see any of B's beams, although the dog at your feet can. And a new raindrop, C, whose beams you couldn't see at all before, has now fallen into the place where A was, and you now see its red beam. That's why a rainbow seems to stay still, although the raindrops that make it are constantly falling through it.
On the right wavelength? Let's now look at what the spectrum, the ordered range of colours from red through orange, yellow, green and blue to violet, really is. What is it about red light that makes it bend at a shallower angle than blue light? Light can be thought of as vibrations, waves. Just as sound is vibrations in the air, light consists of what are called electromagnetic vibrations. I won't try to explain what electromagnetic vibrations are because it takes too long, and I'm not sure that I entirely understand it myself. The point here is that although light is very different from sound, we can talk about high frequency, short wavelength, and low frequency, long wavelength, vibrations in light, just as we can for sound. High pitch sound, treble or soprano, means high frequency or short wavelength vibrations. Low frequency or long wavelength sounds are deep bass sounds. The equivalent for light is that red, long wavelength, is the bass, yellow the baritone, green the tenor, blue the alto, and violet short wavelength, the treble. There are sounds that are too high-pitched for us to hear. They're called ultrasounds. Bats can hear them and use the echoes for finding their way around. There are also sounds that are too low for us to hear. They're called infrasound. Elephants, whales, and some other animals use these deep rumbles for keeping in touch with each other. The deepest bass notes on a big cathedral organ are almost too low to hear. You seem to feel them fluttering your whole body. The range of sounds that we humans can hear is a band of frequencies in the middle, between ultrasound, which is too high for us, but not bats, to hear, and infrasound, which is too low for us, but not elephants, to hear. And the same is true of light. The colour equivalent of ultrasound bat squeaks is ultraviolet, which means beyond violet. Although we can't see ultraviolet light, insects can. There are some flowers that have stripes or other patterns for luring insects in to pollinate them, patterns that can only be seen in the ultraviolet range of wavelengths. Insect eyes can see them, but we need instruments to translate the patterns into the visible part of the spectrum. For example, the evening primrose flower looks yellow to us, with no pattern, no stripes. But if you photograph it in ultraviolet light, you suddenly see a starburst of stripes.
The spectrum goes into higher and higher frequencies, far beyond ultraviolet, far beyond what even insects can see. X-rays could be thought of as light of even higher pitch than ultraviolet, and gamma rays are even higher still. At the other end of the spectrum, insects can't see red, but we can. Beyond red is infrared, which we can't see, although we can feel it as heat, and some snakes are especially sensitive to it, using it to detect their prey. A bee might call red infra-orange. Deeper bass notes than infrared are microwaves, which you use to cook things, and even deeper bass, longer wavelength, are radio waves. What is a bit surprising is that the light we humans can actually see, the spectrum or rainbow of visible colours between the slightly higher-pitched violet and the slightly lower-pitched red, is a tiny band in the middle of a huge spectrum ranging from gamma rays at the high-pitched end to radio waves at the low-pitched end. Almost the whole of the spectrum is invisible to our eyes. The sun and the stars are pumping out electromagnetic rays at a full range of frequencies or pitches, all the way from radio waves at the base end to cosmic rays at the treble end. Although we can't see outside the tiny band of visible light from red to violet, we have instruments that can detect these invisible rays. Scientists, called radio astronomers, take photographs of stars using radio waves rather than light waves or X-rays. The instrument they use is called a radio telescope. Other scientists take photographs of the sky at the other end of the spectrum, in the X-ray band. We learn different things about the stars and about the universe by using different parts of the spectrum. The fact that our eyes can only see through a tiny slit in the middle of the vast spectrum, that we can see only a slender band in the huge range of rays that scientific instruments can see, is a lovely illustration of the power of science to excite our imagination, a lovely example of the magic of the real. In the next chapter, we shall learn something even more wonderful about the rainbow. Splitting the light from a distant star into a spectrum can tell us not only what the star is made of, but also how old it is. And it is evidence of this kind, rainbow evidence, that enables us to work out how old the universe is. When did it all begin? That may sound unlikely, but all will be revealed in the next chapter.
Chapter 8. When and how did everything begin? Let's start with an African myth from a Bantu tribe, the Boshongo of the Congo. In the beginning, there was no land, just watery darkness, and also, importantly, the god Bumba. Bumba got a stomachache and vomited up the sun. Light from the sun dispelled the darkness, and heat from the sun dried up some of the water, leaving land. Bumba's stomachache still hadn't gone, though, So he then sicked up the moon, the stars, animals, and people. Many Chinese origin myths involve a character called Pan Gu, sometimes depicted as a giant hairy man with a dog's head. Here's one of the Pan Gu myths. In the beginning, there was no clear distinction between heaven and earth. It was all one gooey mess surrounding a big black egg. Curled up inside the egg was Pan Gu. Pan Gu slept inside the egg for 18,000 years. When he finally awoke, he wanted to escape, so he picked up his axe and hewed his way out. Some of the contents of the egg were heavy and sank to become the earth. Some of them were light and floated up to become the sky. The earth and the sky then swelled at a rate of the equivalent of 3 meters a day for another 18,000 years. Some versions of the story have Pan Gu pushing the sky and the earth apart, after which he was so exhausted that he died. Various bits of him then became the universe that we know. His breath became the wind, his voice became thunder, his two eyes became the moon and the sun, his muscles farmland, and his veins roads. His sweat became rain, and his hairs became stars. Humans are descended from the fleas and lice that once lived on his body. By the way, the story of Pan Gu pushing the sky and the earth apart is rather like the, probably unrelated, Greek myth of Atlas, who also held up the sky, although weirdly, pictures and statues usually show him carrying the whole earth on his shoulders. Now here is one of many origin myths from India. Before the beginning of time, there was a great dark ocean of nothingness, with a giant snake coiled up on the surface. Sleeping in the coils of the snake was Lord Vishnu. Eventually, Lord Vishnu was awakened by a deep humming sound from the bottom of the ocean of nothingness, and a lotus plant grew out of his navel. In the middle of the lotus flower sat Brahma, Vishnu's servant. Vishnu commanded Brahma to create the world, so Brahma did just that, no problem, and all living creatures too while he was about it, easy. What I find a little disappointing about all these origin myths is that they begin by assuming the existence of some kind of living creature before the universe itself came into being, Bumba or Brahma or Pan Gu or Nkulukulu, the Zulu creator, or Abasi, Nigeria, or Old Man in the Sky, Salish, a tribe of Native Americans from Canada. Wouldn't you think that a universe of some kind would have to come first to provide a place for the creative spirit to go to work? None of the myths gives any explanation for how the creator of the universe himself, and it usually is a he, came into existence. So they don't get us very far. Let's turn instead to what we know of the true story of how the universe began.
How did everything begin, really? Do you remember from chapter 1 that scientists work by setting up models of how the real world might be? They then test each model by using it to make predictions of things that we ought to see, or measurements that we ought to be able to make, if the model were correct. In the middle of the 20th century, there were two competing models for how the universe came into being, called the steady-state model and the Big Bang model. The steady-state model was very elegant, but eventually turned out to be wrong. That is, predictions based on it were shown to be false. According to the steady-state model, there never was a beginning. The universe had always existed in pretty much its present form. The Big Bang model, on the other hand, suggested that the universe began at a definite moment in time in a strange kind of explosion. The predictions made on the basis of the Big Bang model keep turning out to be right, and so it has now been generally accepted by most scientists. According to the modern version of the Big Bang model, the entire observable universe exploded into existence between 13 and 14 billion years ago. Why do we say observable? The observable universe means everything for which we have any evidence at all. It is possible that there are other universes that are inaccessible to all our senses and instruments. Some scientists speculate, perhaps fancifully, that there may be a multiverse, a bubbling foam of universes, of which our universe is only one bubble. Or it may be that the observable universe, the universe in which we live, and the only universe for which we have direct evidence, is the only universe there is. Either way, in this chapter, we are limiting ourselves to the observable universe. The observable universe seems to have begun in the Big Bang, and this remarkable event happened just under 14 billion years ago.
Some scientists will tell you that time itself began in the Big Bang, and we should no more ask what happened before the Big Bang than we should ask what is north of the North Pole. You don't understand that? Nor do I, but I do understand, sort of, the evidence that the Big Bang happened and when. That is what this chapter is about. First, I need to explain what a galaxy is. We've already seen in our analogy with footballs in Chapter 6 that the stars are spaced out at incredibly huge distances from one another compared with the planets orbiting our Sun. But vastly spaced out as they are, the stars are still actually clustered together into groups, and these groups are called galaxies. A galaxy is seen as a white swirling pattern that is actually made up of billions of stars and also clouds of dust and gas. Our Sun is just one of the stars that make up the particular galaxy called the Milky Way. It's called that because on dark nights we get an end-on view of part of it. We see it as a mysterious streak or path of white across the sky, which you might mistake for a long, wispy cloud until you realize what it really is. And when you do, the thought should strike you dumb with awe. Since we are in the Milky Way galaxy, we can never see it in its full glory. The universe, our observable universe, is a very big place.
The next important point is this. It is possible to measure how far away from us each galaxy is. How? How, for that matter, do we know how far away anything in the universe is? For nearby stars, the best method uses something called parallax. Hold your finger up in front of your face and look at it with your left eye closed. Now open your left eye and close your right. Keep switching eyes, and you'll notice that the apparent position of your finger hops from side to side. That is because of the difference between the viewpoints of your two eyes. Move your finger nearer, and the hops will become greater. Move your finger further away, and the hops become smaller. All you need to know is how far apart your eyes are, and you can calculate the distance from eyes to finger by the size of the hops. That is the parallax method of estimating distances. Now, instead of looking at your finger, look at a star out in the night sky, switching from eye to eye. The star won't hop at all. It's much too far away. In order to make a star hop from side to side, your eyes would need to be millions of miles apart. How can we achieve the same effect as switching eyes millions of miles apart? We can make use of the fact that the Earth's orbit around the Sun has a diameter of 186 million miles. We measure the position of a nearby star against a background of other stars. Then, 6 months later, when the Earth is 186 million miles away at the opposite side of its orbit, we measure the apparent position of the star again. If the star is quite close, its apparent position will have hopped. From the length of the hop, it is easy to calculate how far away the star is. Unfortunately, though, the parallax method works only for nearby stars. For distant stars, and certainly for other galaxies, our two alternating eyes would need to be much further apart than 186 million miles. We have to find another method. You might think you could do it by measuring how brightly the galaxy seems to shine. Surely a more distant galaxy should be dimmer than a closer one. Trouble is that the two galaxies might really be of different brightnesses. It's like estimating how far away a lit candle is. If some candles are brighter than others, how would you know whether you were looking at a bright candle far away or a dim candle nearby? Fortunately, astronomers have evidence that certain special kinds of stars are what they call standard candles. They understand enough of what is going on in these stars to know how bright they are. Not as we see them, but their actual brightness, the intensity of the light, or it might be X-rays or some other kind of radiation that we can measure, before it starts its long journey to our telescopes. They also know how to identify these special candles, and so, as long as they can find at least one of them in a galaxy, astronomers can use it, with the assistance of well-established mathematical calculations, to estimate how far away the galaxy is. So we have the parallax method for measuring very short distances, and there is a ladder, so to speak, of various kinds of standard candles that we can use for measuring a range of increasingly great distances, stretching out even to very distant galaxies.
Rainbows and redshift. OK, so now we know what a galaxy is and how to find out its distance from us. For the next step in the argument, we need to make use of the light spectrum, which we met in Chapter 7 on the rainbow. I was once asked to contribute a chapter to a book in which scientists were invited to nominate the most important invention ever. It was fun, but I had left it rather late before joining the party, and all the obvious inventions had already been taken: the wheel, the printing press, the telephone, the computer, and so on. So I chose an instrument that I was pretty sure nobody else would choose, and is certainly very important, even though not many people have ever used one, and I must confess that I've never used one myself. I chose the spectroscope. A spectroscope is a rainbow machine. If it is attached to a telescope, it takes the light from one particular star or galaxy and spreads it out as a spectrum, just as Newton did with his prism. But it is more sophisticated than Newton's prism because it allows you to make exact measurements along the spread-out spectrum of starlight. Measurements of what? What is there to measure in a rainbow? Well, this is where it starts to get really interesting. The light from different stars produces rainbows that are different in very particular ways. This can tell us a lot about the stars. Does this mean that starlight has a whole variety of strange new colours, colours that we never see on Earth? No, definitely not. You have already seen on Earth all the colours that your eyes are capable of seeing. Do you find that disappointing? I did when I first understood it. When I was a child, I used to love Hugh Lofting's Dr. Doolittle books. In one of the books, the doctor flies to the moon and is enchanted to behold a completely new range of colours never before seen by human eyes. I love this thought. For me, it stood for the exciting idea that our own familiar Earth may not be typical of everything in the universe. Unfortunately, though that idea is worthwhile, the story was not true, could not be true. That follows from Newton's discovery that the colours we see are all contained in white light and are all revealed when white light is spread out by a prism. There are no colours outside the range we are used to. Artists may come up with any number of different tints and shades, but all these are combinations of those basic component colours of white light. The colours we see inside our heads are really just labels made up by the brain to identify light of different wavelengths. We've already encountered the complete range of wavelengths here on Earth. Neither the moon nor the stars have any surprises to offer in the colour department, alas. So, what did I mean when I said that different stars produce different rainbows, with differences we can measure using a spectroscope? Well, it turns out that when starlight is splayed out by a spectroscope, strange patterns of thin black lines appear in very particular places along the spectrum. Or sometimes the lines are not black but coloured, and the background is black. The patterns of lines look like a barcode, the sort of barcode you see on things you buy in shops to identify them at the cash till. Different stars have the same rainbow, but different patterns of lines across it, and this pattern really is a kind of barcode because it tells us a lot about the star and what it is made of. It isn't only starlight that shows the barcode lines. Lights on Earth do too, so we've been able to investigate in the laboratory what makes them. And what makes the barcodes, it turns out, is different elements. Sodium, for example, has prominent lines in the yellow part of the spectrum. Sodium light, produced by an electric arc in sodium vapour, glows yellow. The reason for this is understood by physical scientists, but not by me because I'm a biological scientist who doesn't understand quantum theory. When I went to school in the city of Salisbury in southern England, I remember being utterly fascinated by the weird sight of my bright red school cap in the yellow light of the street lamps. It didn't look red anymore, but a yellowish brown. So did the bright red double-decker buses. The reason was this. Like many other English towns in those days, Salisbury used sodium vapour lamps for its streetlights. These give off light only in the narrow regions of the spectrum covered by sodium's characteristic lines, and by far the brightest of sodium's lines are in the yellow. To all intents and purposes, sodium lights glow with a pure yellow light, very different from the white of sunlight or the vaguely yellowish light of an ordinary electric bulb. Since there was virtually no red at all in the light supplied by the sodium lamps, no red light could be reflected from my cap. If you are wondering what makes a cap or a bus red in the first place, the answer is that the molecules of dye or paint absorb most of the light of all colours except red. So in white light, which contains all wavelengths, mostly red light is reflected. Under sodium vapour street lamps, there is no red light to be reflected, hence the yellowy-brown colour. Sodium is just one example. You'll remember from Chapter 4 that every element has its own unique atomic number, which is the number of protons in its nucleus, and also the number of electrons orbiting it. Well, for reasons connected with the orbits of its electrons, every element also has its own unique effect upon light. Unique, like a barcode. In fact, a barcode is pretty much what the pattern of lines in the spectrum of starlight is. You can tell which of the 92 naturally occurring elements are present in a star by spreading the star's light out in a spectroscope and looking at the barcode lines in the spectrum. So, sodium's lines are mostly in the yellow. Hydrogen produces four bars, one in the violet part of the spectrum, one in the dark blue, one in the pale blue, and one in the red. Since every element has a different barcode pattern, we can look at the light from any star and see which elements are present in that star. Admittedly, it's quite tricky because the barcodes of several different elements are likely to be muddled up together, but there are ways of sorting them out. What a wonderful tool the spectroscope is. It gets even better. The sodium spectrum we would measure in light from a Salisbury street lamp is the same as from a star that is not very far away. Most of the stars we see, for example, the stars in the well-known constellations of the zodiac, are in our own galaxy. But if you look at the sodium spectrum from a star in a different galaxy, you get a fascinatingly different picture. Sodium light from a very distant galaxy has the same pattern of bars spaced the same distance from each other, but the whole pattern is shifted towards the red end of the spectrum. How do we know it is still sodium then? The answer is because the pattern of spacing between the bars is the same. That might not seem totally convincing if it only happened with sodium, but the same thing happens with all the elements. In every case we see the same spacing pattern, characteristic of the element concerned, but shifted bodily along the spectrum towards the red end. What's more, for any given galaxy, all the barcodes are shifted the same distance along the spectrum. If you look at the sodium barcode in light from a galaxy that is somewhat close to ours, closer than the very distant galaxies I talked about in the previous paragraph, but further away than the stars in our own Milky Way galaxy, you see an intermediate shift. You see the same spacing pattern, which is the signature of sodium, but not shifted so far. The first line is shifted along the spectrum away from deep blue, but not as far as green, only as far as light blue. And the yellow line, responsible for the yellow colour of the Salisbury street lamps, is shifted in the same direction towards the red end of the spectrum, but not all the way into the red as it is in light from the distant galaxy, only a little way into the orange. Sodium is just one example. Any other element shows the same shift along the spectrum in the red direction. The more distant the galaxy, the greater the shift towards the red. This is called the Hubble shift, because it was discovered by the great American astronomer Edwin Hubble, who also gave his name after his death to the Hubble telescope. It's also called a red shift, because the shift is along the spectrum in the direction of red.
Backwards to the Big Bang. What does the red shift mean? Fortunately, scientists understand it well. It is an example of what is called a Doppler shift. Doppler shifts can happen wherever we have waves, and light, as we saw in the previous chapter, consists of waves. It's often called the Doppler effect, and it is more familiar to us from sound waves. When you are standing at a roadside, watching the cars whiz by at high speed, the sound of every car's engine seems to drop in pitch as it passes you. You know the car's engine note really stays the same, so why does the pitch seem to drop? The answer is the Doppler shift, and the explanation for it is as follows. Sound travels through the air as waves of changing air pressure. When you listen to the note of a car engine, or let's say a trumpet because it's more pleasant than an engine, sound waves travel through the air in all directions from the source of the sound. Your ear happens to lie in one of those directions. It picks up the changes in air pressure produced by the trumpet, and your brain hears them as sound. Don't imagine molecules of air flowing from the trumpet all the way to your ear. It isn't like that at all. That would be a wind, and wind travels in one direction only, whereas sound waves travel outwards in all directions, like the waves on the surface of a pond when you drop a pebble in. The easiest kind of wave to understand is the so-called Mexican wave, in which people in a large sports stadium stand up and then sit down again in order, each person doing so immediately after the person on one side of them, say their left side. A wave of standing and then sitting moves swiftly around the stadium. Nobody actually moves from their place, yet the wave travels. Indeed, the wave travels far faster than anybody could run. What travels in the pond is a wave of changing height in the surface of the water. The thing that makes it a wave is that the water molecules themselves are not rushing outwards from the pebble. The water molecules are just going up and down, like the people in the stadium. Nothing really travels outwards from the pebble. It only looks like that because the high points and low points of the water move outwards.
Sound waves are a bit different. What travels in the case of sound waves is a wave of changing air pressure. The air molecules move a little bit, to and fro, away from the trumpet, or whatever is the source of the sound, and back again. As they do so, they knock against neighbouring air molecules and set them moving backwards and forwards too. Those in turn knock against their neighbours, and the result is that a wave of molecule knocking, which amounts to a wave of changing pressure, travels outwards from the trumpet in all directions. And it is the wave that travels from the trumpet to your ear, not the air molecules themselves. The wave travels at a fixed speed regardless of whether the source of the sound is a trumpet or a speaking voice or a car, about 768 miles per hour in air, four times faster underwater and even faster in some solids. If you play a higher note on your trumpet, the speed at which the waves travel remains the same, but the distance between the wave crests, the wavelength, becomes shorter. Play a low note and the wave crests space out more, but the wave still travels at the same speed. So high notes have a shorter wavelength than low ones. That is what sound waves are. Now for the Doppler shift. Imagine that a trumpeter standing on a snow-covered hillside plays a long, sustained note. You get on a toboggan and speed past the trumpeter. I chose a toboggan rather than a car because it is quiet, so you can hear the trumpet. What will you hear? The successive wave crests leave the trumpet at a definite distance from each other, defined by the note the trumpeter chose to play. But when you are whizzing towards the trumpeter, your ear will gobble up the successive wave crests at a higher rate than if you were standing still on the hilltop. So the trumpet's note will sound higher than it really is. Then, after you've whizzed past the trumpeter, your ear will hit the successive wave crest at a lower rate. They'll seem more spaced out, because each wave crest is travelling in the same direction as your toboggan. So the apparent pitch of the note will be lower than it really is. The same thing works if your ear is still and the source of the sound moves. It is said, I don't know whether it's true, but it's a nice story, that Christian Doppler, the Austrian scientist who discovered the effect, hired a brass band to play on an open railway truck in order to demonstrate it. The tune the band was playing suddenly dropped into a lower key as the train puffed past the amazed audience.
Light waves are different again, not really like a Mexican wave and not really like sound waves, but they do have their own version of the Doppler effect. Remember that the red end of the spectrum has a longer wavelength than the blue end, with green in the middle. Suppose the bandsmen on Christian Doppler's railway truck are all wearing yellow uniforms. As the train speeds towards you, your eyes gobble up the wave crests at a faster rate than they would if the train was still. So there is a slight shift in the colour of the uniform towards the green part of the spectrum. Now, when the train goes past you and is speeding away from you, the opposite happens and the band uniforms appear slightly redder. There's only one thing wrong with this illustration. In order for you to notice the blue shift or the red shift, the train would have to be travelling at millions of miles per hour. Trains don't travel anywhere near fast enough for the Doppler effect on colour to be noticed. But galaxies do. The shift of the spectrum towards the red end shows that very distant galaxies are travelling away from us at a rate of hundreds of millions of miles per hour. And the more distant they are, as measured by the standard candles mentioned before, the faster they are travelling away from us, the greater the red shift. All the galaxies in the universe are rushing away from each other, which means that they are rushing away from us too. It doesn't matter which direction you point your telescope in, the more distant galaxies are moving away from us and from one another at ever-increasing speed. The entire universe, space itself, is expanding at a colossal rate. In that case, you might ask, why is it only at the level of galaxies that space is seen to expand? Why don't the stars within a galaxy rush away from each other? Why aren't you and I rushing away from each other? The answer is that clusters of things that are close to each other, like everything in a galaxy, feel the strongest pull from the gravity of their neighbours. This holds them together, while distant objects, other galaxies, recede with the expansion of the universe.
And now here is something amazing. Astronomers have looked at the expansion and worked backwards through time. It is as though they constructed a movie of the expanding universe with the galaxies rushing apart and then ran the film in reverse. Instead of hurtling away from each other, in the backwards film, the galaxies converge. And from that film, the astronomers can calculate back to the moment when the expansion of the universe must have begun. They can even calculate when that moment was. That's how they know it was somewhere between 13 and 14 billion years ago. That was the moment when the universe itself began, the moment called the Big Bang. Today's models of the universe assume that it wasn't only the universe that began with the Big Bang. Time itself and space itself began with the Big Bang too. Don't ask me to explain that, because not being a cosmologist, I don't understand it myself, but perhaps you can now see why I nominated the spectroscope as one of the most important inventions ever. Rainbows are not just beautiful to look at. In a way, they tell us when everything began, including time and space. I think that makes the rainbow even more beautiful.
Chapter 11. Why do bad things happen? Why do bad things happen? After a dreadful disaster, such as an earthquake or a hurricane, you'll hear people saying things like, "It's so unfair. What did those poor people ever do to deserve such a fate?" If a really good person gets a painful disease and dies, while a really bad person remains in the best of health, once again we cry, "Unfair," or we say, "Where's the justice in that?" It is hard to resist this feeling that, somehow, there ought to be a kind of natural justice. Good things should happen to good people. Bad things, if they must happen at all, should only happen to bad people. In Oscar Wilde's delightful play, The Importance of Being Earnest, an elderly governess called Miss Prism explains how, long ago, she wrote a novel. When she is asked whether it ended happily, she replies, "The good ended happily and the bad unhappily. That is what fiction means." Real life is different. Bad things do happen, and they happen to good people as well as bad. Why? Why is real life not like Miss Prism's fiction? Why do bad things happen? Lots of peoples believe that their gods intended to create a perfect world, but unfortunately something went wrong. and there are almost as many ideas about what that something was. The Dogon tribe of West Africa believe that at the beginning of the world there was a cosmic egg from which two twins hatched. All would have been well if the twins had hatched at the same time. Unfortunately, one of them hatched too soon and spoiled the god's plan of perfection. That, according to the Dogon, is why bad things happen.
There are lots of legends about how death came into the world. All over Africa, different tribes believe that the chameleon was given the news of everlasting life and told to carry it to humans. Unfortunately, the chameleon walked so slowly, they do, I know, as a child in Africa I had a pet chameleon called Hokaraya, that the news of death, carried by a nippier lizard, or other faster animal in other versions of the legend, arrived first. In one West African legend, the news of life was brought by a slow toad, unfortunately overtaken by a fast dog, bringing the news of death. I must say I'm a bit puzzled why the order in which news arrives should matter so much. Bad news is still bad whenever it arrives.
Disease is a special kind of bad thing, and it has spawned plenty of myths of its own. One reason is that for a long time diseases were rather mysterious. Our ancestors faced other dangers, from lions and saber-tooths, from enemy tribes, from the threat of starvation, but you could see them coming and understand them. Smallpox, on the other hand, or the Black Death, or malaria, must have seemed to pounce from nowhere, without warning, and it wasn't obvious how to guard against these assaults. It was a terrifying mystery. Where did diseases come from? What did we do to deserve this painful death, this agonizing toothache, or these hideous spots? No wonder people resorted to superstition when desperately trying to understand disease, and even more desperately trying to protect themselves from it. In many African tribes, until quite recently, anybody who got ill or had a sick child would automatically look around for an evil magician or witch to blame. If my child has a high fever, it must be because an enemy paid a witch doctor to cast a spell on her. Or maybe it is because I couldn't afford to sacrifice a goat when she was born. Or perhaps it is because a green caterpillar walked across the path in front of me and I forgot to spit out the evil spirit. In ancient Greece, sick pilgrims would spend the night in a temple dedicated to Asclepius, the god of healing and medicine. They believed the god would either heal them himself or reveal the cure in a dream. Even today, a surprisingly large number of sick people travel to places like Lourdes, where they plunge into a sacred pool in the hope that the holy water will heal them. Actually, one might suspect that they're more likely to catch something from all the other people who've bathed in the same water. About 200 million people have made the pilgrimage to Lourdes during the past 140 years, hoping for a cure. In many cases, there's not much wrong with them, and thankfully they mostly get better, as they would have anyway, with or without the pilgrimage. Hippocrates, the ancient Greek father of medicine, who gives his name to the oath of good conduct that all doctors are supposed to observe, thought that earthquakes were important causes of disease. In the Middle Ages, many people believed that diseases were caused by the movements of the planets against the backdrop of stars. That's part of a system of beliefs called astrology, which, ridiculous as it may seem, still has quite a few followers to this day. The most persistent myth about health and disease, lasting from the 5th century BC right up to the 18th century AD, was the myth of the four humours. When we say, he is in a good humour today, that's where the word comes from, although people don't believe in the idea behind it any more. The four humours were black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm. Good health was thought to depend on a good balance between them, and you can still hear something a bit similar from quack healers today, who will wave their hands over you in order to balance your energies or your chakras. The theory of the four humours certainly couldn't help doctors to cure illnesses, but it might have done no great harm except that it led to the practice of bleeding patients. This involved opening a vein with a sharp instrument called a lancet and drawing off quantities of blood into a special basin. This, of course, made the poor patient even sicker. It contributed to George Washington's death. but the doctors believe so strongly in the ancient myth of the humours that they did it again and again. What's more, people didn't only get bled when they were ill. Sometimes they asked the doctor to do it in advance of getting ill, in the hope that it would ward off sickness.
Once, when I was at school, our teacher asked us to think about why diseases happen. One boy put his hand up and suggested that it was because of sin. There are many people, even today, who think something like that is the cause of bad things generally. Some myths suggest that bad things happen in the world because our ancestors did something wicked long ago. I've already mentioned the Jewish myth of the founding ancestors, Adam and Eve. You'll remember that Adam and Eve did a simply terrible thing. They allowed themselves to be persuaded by the snake to eat the fruit of a forbidden tree. This mythical crime has reverberated down the ages and is still regarded by some people as responsible for all the bad things that happen in the world to this day.
Lots of myths talk about a conflict between good gods and bad gods or devils. The bad gods are responsible for the bad things that happen in the world. Or there may be a single spirit of evil, called the devil or something similar, who fights with the good god or gods. If only there wasn't this tussle between devils and gods, or good gods and bad gods, bad things wouldn't happen.
Is there really life on other planets? Nobody knows. If you forced me to give an opinion one way or the other, I'd say yes, and probably on millions of planets. But who cares about an opinion? There's no direct evidence. One of the great virtues of science is that scientists know when they don't know the answer to something. They cheerfully admit that they don't know. Cheerfully, because not knowing the answer is an exciting challenge to try to find it. One day, we may have definite evidence of life on other planets, and then we'll know for sure. For now, the best a scientist can do is write down the kind of information that might reduce the uncertainty, might take us from guesswork to an estimate of likelihood. And that in itself is an interesting and challenging thing to do.
The first thing we might ask is how many planets there are. Until quite recently, it was possible to believe that the ones orbiting our sun were the only ones, because planets could not be detected by even the largest telescopes. Nowadays, we have good evidence that lots of stars have planets, and new extrasolar planets are discovered almost every day. An extrasolar planet is a planet orbiting a star other than the sun. Sol is the Latin for sun, and extra is the Latin for outside. You might think that the obvious way to detect a planet is to see it through a telescope. Unfortunately, planets are too dim to be seen at any great distance. They don't glow in their own right, but only reflect their star's light, so we can't see them directly. We have to rely on indirect methods, and the best method again makes use of the spectroscope, the instrument we met in Chapter 8. Here's how. When a heavenly body orbits another one of approximately equal size, they orbit each other because they exert approximately equal gravitational force on each other. Several of the bright stars that we see when we look up are actually two stars, so-called binaries, in orbit around each other like the two ends of a dumbbell connected by an invisible rod. When one body is much smaller than the other, as is the case with a planet and its star, the smaller one whizzes around the larger one, while the larger one makes only little token movements in response to the gravitational pull of the smaller. We say that Earth orbits the Sun, but actually the Sun also makes tiny movements in response to the gravity of Earth. And a planet as large as Jupiter can have an appreciable effect on the position of its star. These token movements of a star are too small to count as going round the planet, but they are large enough to be detected by our instruments, even though we can't see the planet at all.
How we detect these movements is interesting in its own right. Any star is too far away for us to be able to see it actually moving, even with a powerful telescope. But strangely, although we can't see a star move, we can measure the speed with which it does so. That sounds odd, but this is where the spectroscope comes in. Remember the Doppler shift from Chapter 8? When the star's movement happens to be away from us, the light from it will be red-shifted. When the star's movement is towards us, its light will be blue-shifted. So if a star has an orbiting planet, the spectroscope will show us a rhythmically pulsating red-blue-red-blue shift pattern, and the timing of these regular shifts will tell us the length of the planet's year. Of course, it's complicated when there's more than one planet, but astronomers are good at mathematics, and they can cope with that complication. At the time of writing, January 2011, 484 planets have been detected by this means, orbiting 408 stars. There will surely be more by the time you hear this. There are other methods of detecting planets. For example, when a planet passes across the face of its star, a small portion of the face of the star is obscured or eclipsed, like when we see the moon eclipsing the sun, except that the moon looks much bigger because it is so much closer. When a planet comes between us and its star, the star becomes very, very slightly dimmer, and sometimes our instruments are sensitive enough to detect this dimming. So far, 110 planets have been discovered in this way. And there are a few other methods too, which have detected another 35 planets. Some planets have been detected by more than one of these techniques, and the present grand total is 519 planets orbiting stars in our galaxy other than the Sun. In our galaxy, the great majority of stars where we have looked for planets have turned out to possess them. So, assuming our galaxy is typical, we can probably conclude that most of the stars in the universe have planets in orbit around them. The number of stars in our galaxy is about 100 billion, and the number of galaxies in the universe is about the same again. That means something like 10,000 billion billion stars in total. About 10% of known stars are described by astronomers as sun-like. Stars that are very different from the Sun, even if they have planets, are unlikely to support life on those planets for various reasons. For example, stars that are much bigger than the Sun tend not to last long enough before exploding. But even if we confine ourselves to the planets orbiting Sun-like stars, we're likely to be dealing in billions of billions, and that would probably still be an underestimate. All right, but how many of those planets orbiting the right kind of star are likely to be suitable for supporting life? The majority of extrasolar planets discovered so far are Jupiters. That means they are gas giants, mostly made of gas at high pressure. This is not surprising, as our methods of detecting planets are usually not sensitive enough to notice anything smaller than Jupiters. And Jupiters, gas giants, are not suitable for life as we know it. Of course, that doesn't mean that life as we know it is the only possible kind of life. There might even be life on Jupiter itself, although I doubt it. We don't know what proportion of those billions of billions of planets are Earth-like rocky planets, as opposed to Jupiter-like gas giants. But even if the proportion is quite low, the absolute number will still be high because the total is so huge.
Looking for Goldilocks. Life as we know it depends on water. Once again, we should beware of fixing our attention on life as we know it, but for the moment, exobiologists, scientists searching for extraterrestrial life, regard water as essential, so much so that a good part of their effort is given over to searching the heavens for signs of it. Water is a lot easier to detect than life itself. If we find water, it certainly doesn't mean there has to be life, but it's a step in the right direction. For life as we know it to exist, at least some of the water has to be in liquid form. Ice won't do, nor will steam. Close inspection of Mars shows evidence of liquid water in the past, if not today. And several other planets have at least some water, even if it's not in liquid form. Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, is covered with ice, and it's been plausibly suggested that under the ice is a sea of liquid water. People once thought Mars was the best candidate for extraterrestrial life within the solar system, and a famous astronomer called Percival Lowell even drew what he claimed were canals crisscrossing its surface. Spacecraft have now taken detailed photographs of Mars and have even landed on its surface, and the canals have turned out to be figments of Lowell's imagination. Nowadays, Europa has taken the place of Mars as the prime site of speculation about extraterrestrial life in our own solar system, but most scientists think we have to look further afield. Evidence suggests that water is not particularly rare on extrasolar planets. What about temperature? How finely tuned does the temperature of a planet have to be if it is to support life? Scientists talk of a so-called Goldilocks zone, just right, like baby bear's porridge, between two wrong extremes of too hot, like father bear's porridge, and too cold, like mother bear's porridge. The orbit of Earth is just right for life, not too close to the sun, where water would boil, and not too far from the sun, where all the water would freeze solid and there wouldn't be enough sunlight to feed the plants. Although there are billions and billions of planets out there, we cannot expect more than a minority of them to be just right, where temperature and distance from their star are concerned. Recently, May 2011, a Goldilocks planet was discovered orbiting a star called Gliese 581, which is about 20 light-years away from us. Not very far as stars go, but still a vast distance by human standards. The star is a red dwarf, much smaller than the Sun, and its Goldilocks zone is correspondingly closer in. It has at least six planets, named Gliese 581e, b, c, g, d, and f. Several of them are small, rocky planets like Earth, and one of them, Gliese 581d, is thought to be in the Goldilocks zone for liquid water. It's not known whether Gliese 581d actually has water, but if so, it's likely to be liquid rather than ice or vapour. Nobody is suggesting that Gliese 581d actually does have life, but the fact that it has been discovered so soon after we started looking makes one think there are probably lots of Goldilocks planets out there.
What about the size of a planet? Is there a Goldilocks size, not too big and not too small, but just right? The size of a planet, more strictly its mass, has a big impact upon life because of gravity. A planet with the same diameter as Earth, but mostly made of solid gold, would have a mass more than three times as great. The gravitational pull of the planet would be over three times as strong as we are used to on Earth. Everything would weigh more than three times as much, and that includes any living bodies on the planet. Putting one foot in front of the other would be a great labor. An animal the size of a mouse would need to have thick bones to support its body, and it would lumber about like a miniature rhinoceros, while an animal the size of a rhinoceros might suffocate under its own weight. Just as gold is heavier than the iron, nickel, and other things that Earth is mostly made of, coal is much lighter. A planet the size of Earth but mostly made of coal would have a gravitational pull only about a fifth as strong as we are used to. An animal the size of a rhinoceros could skitter about on thin, spindly legs like a spider. And animals far bigger than the largest dinosaurs could happily evolve if the other conditions on the planet were right. The Moon's gravity is about one-sixth that of Earth. That is why astronauts on the Moon moved with a curious bounding gait, which looked quite comical because of their large bulk in their spacesuits. An animal that actually evolved on a planet with such weak gravity would be built very differently. Natural selection would see to that.
If the gravitational pull were too strong, as it would be on a neutron star, there could be no life at all. A neutron star is a kind of collapsed star. As we learned in Chapter 4, matter normally consists almost entirely of empty space. The distance between atomic nuclei is vast compared with the size of the nuclei themselves. But in a neutron star, the collapsing means that all that empty space has gone. A neutron star can have as much mass as the Sun, yet be only the size of a city, so its gravitational pull is shatteringly strong. If you were plonked down on a neutron star, you would weigh 100 billion times what you weigh on Earth. You'd be flattened. You couldn't move. A planet would only need to have a tiny fraction of the gravitational pull of a neutron star to put it outside the Goldilocks zone, not just for life as we know it, but for life as we could possibly imagine it.
Here's looking at you. If there are living creatures on other planets, what might they look like? There's a widespread feeling that it's a bit lazy for science fiction authors to make them look like humans, with just a few things changed, bigger heads or extra eyes or maybe wings. Even when they are not humanoid, most fictional aliens are pretty clearly just modified versions of familiar creatures, such as spiders, octopuses, or mushrooms. But perhaps it is not just lazy, not just a lack of imagination. Perhaps there really is good reason to suppose that aliens, if there are any, and I think there probably are, might not look too unfamiliar to us. Fictional aliens are proverbially described as bug-eyed monsters, so I'll take eyes as my example. I could have taken legs or wings or ears, or even wondered why animals don't have wheels. But I'll stick to eyes and try to show that it isn't really lazy to think that aliens, if there are any, might very well have eyes. Eyes are pretty good things to have, and that's going to be true on most planets. Light travels for practical purposes in straight lines. Wherever light is available, such as in the vicinity of a star, it is technically easy to use light rays to find your way around, to navigate, to locate objects. Any planet that has life is pretty much bound to be in the vicinity of a star, because a star is the obvious source of the energy that all life needs. So the chances are good that light will be available wherever life is present. And where light is present, it is very likely that eyes will evolve, because they're so useful. It is no surprise that eyes have evolved on our planet dozens of times independently. There are only so many ways to make an eye, and I think every one of them has evolved somewhere in our animal kingdom. There's the camera eye, which, like the camera itself, is a darkened chamber with a small hole at the front letting in light through a lens which focuses an upside-down image on a screen, the retina, at the back. Even a lens is not essential. A simple hole will do the job if it's small enough, but that means that very little light gets through, so the image is very dim, unless the planet happens to get a lot more light from its star than we get from the sun. This is, of course, possible, in which case the aliens could indeed have pinhole eyes. Human eyes have a lens to increase the amount of light that is focused on the retina. The retina at the back is carpeted with cells that are sensitive to light and tell the brain about it via nerves. All vertebrates have this kind of eye, and the camera eye has been independently evolved by lots of other kinds of animals, including octopuses, and invented by human designers too, of course.
Jumping spiders have a weird kind of scanning eye. It's sort of like a camera eye, except that the retina, instead of being a broad carpet of light-sensitive cells, is a narrow strip. The strip retina is attached to muscles which move it about so that it scans the scene in front of the spider. Interestingly, that's a bit like what a television camera does too, since it has only a single channel to send a whole image along. It scans across and down in lines, but does it so fast that the picture we receive looks like a single image. Jumping spider eyes don't scan so fast, and they tend to concentrate on interesting parts of the scene, such as flies, but the principle is the same. Then there's the compound eye, which is found in insects, shrimps, and various other animal groups. A compound eye consists of hundreds of tubes radiating out from the center of a hemisphere, each tube looking in a slightly different direction. Each tube is capped by a little lens, so you could think of it as a miniature eye. But the lens doesn't form a usable image, it just concentrates the light in the tube. Since each tube accepts light from a different direction, the brain can combine the information from them all to reconstruct an image, rather a crude image, but good enough to let dragonflies, for instance, catch moving prey on the wing. Our largest telescopes use a curved mirror rather than a lens, and this principle too is used in animal eyes, specifically in scallops. The scallop eye uses a curved mirror to focus an image on a retina, which is in front of the mirror. This inevitably gets in the way of some of the light, as the equivalent does in reflecting telescopes, but it doesn't matter too much as most of the light gets through to the mirror. That list pretty much exhausts the ways of making an eye that scientists can imagine, and all of them have evolved in animals on this planet, most of them more than once. It is a good bet that if there are creatures on other planets that can see, they will be using eyes of a kind that we would find familiar.
Let's exercise our imaginations a bit more.